Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to this discussion on Cardinal Norman Gorey, which we put on in very late notice, and it's great to see you all here. We're having this discussion tonight on the occasion of John Luttrell's book, Norman Thomas Gorey, An Obedient Life. So we're going to lead off with Dr. Luttrell, who's an author of this book and other books, and then we're going to get the Reverend Ed Campion to give an opinion on the book, because he was involved and he read the book early on and gave an endorsement to the book, along with our Deputy Director Anne Henderson gave an endorsement to the book. And then we'll go to questions and discussion. So the topic of tonight's talk is A Cardinal and Servant, Norman Thomas Gorey. So we'll start off with John, we'll go to Ed. Thanks.
Thank you, Jared and friends. Why revisit the life of Norman Gorey? For many Australians over the age of 60, Cardinal Gorey is a key face and image of the Catholic Church of their youth. For three decades after 1945, a mention of the Cardinal would immediately have meant Norman Thomas Gorey. Many have met him personally, or they've attended ceremonies where he presided. They remember the broad smile, his formal language, and they might imitate his intonation. But these memories would be likely to be of the 1960s only. His actual influence and career as a church leader spans nearly four decades, from his appointment as Bishop of Port Augusta in 1935 to his retirement as Archbishop of Sydney in 1971. Only John Bede Poulding had a longer term as Archbishop of Sydney. Over 31 years, Gorey oversaw the life of the largest diocese in Australia during World War II, and then as it doubled in population to over 700,000 Catholics by 1971. And that's 100,000 more than it is today. He responded to the growth by creating over 70 new parishes in the Archdiocese. And that meant new churches, schools to be built and paid for by the community. And almost weekly blessings of foundation stones and new buildings. So recent archbishops have struggled to maintain these individual parishes as the number of their clergy has diminished. The large central administration of today's Catholic Church in Sydney owes much to Gorey. When he became Archbishop, much of Catholic life was directed by parish priests or religious congregations. The archdiocesan bureaucracy was just a few clerical secretaries at St Mary's Cathedral. Today, the multi-storied Poulding Centre in Sydney houses major offices like the Chancery, Catholic Development Fund, Catholic Weekly Newspaper, Confraternity of Christian Doctrine, Catholic Youth Services, and the Catholic Immigration Office. Then there's the extensive Catholic Education Offices with its central location at Leichhardt, and also three regional offices. And that employs thousands of teachers and staff. These and other central organisations began in Gorey's time, although they were comparatively small when he retired. They weren't unique to Sydney, but his significance lies more in persuading and leading the Catholics of Sydney to accept This increased centralisation, the coordination and the extension of services at the expense of some of the local autonomy, which had been held by parishes and other organisations. From the 1840s, most Australian priests had been Irish-born, and Irish bishops had led the Archdiocese of Sydney and most other dioceses in Australia, say from the 1880s at least. Gilroy, as the first Australian-born Archbishop of Sydney, was a central figure in the Australianisation of the Archdiocese and the Australian Church. His role as a standard-bearer for the Australian clergy was actually foisted on him by apostolic delegates who sought to have Australian-born clergy succeed the mostly Irish bishops of the time. So in 1937, delegate Giovanni Panico pressured the Irish-born Archbishop Michael Sheehan to resign, and Gilroy was quickly installed as coadjutor to the aged Archbishop Michael Kelly. After Kelly died in 1940 and the number of Irish clergy declined, Gilroy gradually appointed Australians to leadership positions in the diocesan administration, in the seminaries, and in the parishes. His office at St Mary's Cathedral seemed almost a school for continuing Australianisation. 9 of his former secretaries and aides were ordained bishops, and they were all Australian-born. So far, we've concentrated on his significance in the Archdiocese of Sydney. In the international church before 1945, Australia had been a backwater, especially in the isolation of World War II. Straight after the war, Gilroy featured as one of 32 new cardinals created by Pope Pius XII. In Catholic understanding of the time, cardinals were styled as princes under the papal monarch. They took precedence over bishops. Only cardinals could elect a pope or be elected as pope. They could act as delegate for the pope in a period when popes themselves did not travel outside Italy. Gilroy helped to give Australia a higher profile within the international church by his many travels as cardinal and papal legate, by his role as leader of the Australian bishops in Vatican II, and as president of its 1962 session, and also by his extensive contacts with other leaders, reaching back to his days in Rome as a student. He could bring his cardinal peers to Australia to see it for themselves. The Gargianian from Rome, Gracias from India, Spelman and O'Hara from America, McQuaid from Dublin, Heenan from England, and finally Pope Paul VI. One could argue that his international status during his career was at least as high as that of any other Australian church leader before or since. His elevation also meant that from 1946 he presided over meetings of the Australian bishops, and that included the senior ones like Archbishops Mannix and Duhigg. And in at least the popular imagination, he was seen as their leader. A title, Cardinal and Servant Norman Thomas Gilroy. That's for tonight. The title captures well much of Gilroy's story. He accepted that the Catholic Church had a hierarchy, Pope, cardinals, bishops, clergy, all with the religious authority over the lay faithful. He embraced the elevated concept of cardinal with visits to Australian dioceses in the late 1940s, wearing the Kappa Magna, which was a scarlet cloak with meters of train, and holding out his hand to kneeling Catholics to kiss the cardinal ring. And he used his status also to good effect with the Vatican to locate a document which proved crucial for the cause of canonisation of Mary MacKillop. That was a document which his predecessor, Archbishop Kelly, had been unable to locate. Whether he was seduced into enjoying the trappings of hierarchical authority, I cannot say. But it does bring me to the servant caption in our discussion title. My general belief is that he did not seek status and authority. His first employment was in the postal service, and then a year serving in the Navy. In retirement, he reflected that, quote, all I ever wanted was to be a priest, unquote. It was not just rhetoric, because when newly ordained as a priest in 1924 and asked to be secretary to the papal delegation in Australia, he wrote to his bishop in Lismore that he would much rather be a priest in his diocese. 10 years later, when apostolic delegate Bernardini informed him that Pope Pius XI had chosen him to be Bishop of Port Augusta in South Australia, he wrote in reply, your terrifying letter of the 19th has filled me with awe. My ambition was a complete annihilation in the Society of Jesus by the superiors of which I was accepted. It was my ambition to be a Jesuit because I thought that was God's will in my regard. My ambition is still to do his will. If the Holy Father indicates Port Augusta as God's will for me, I submit with my whole heart. Your obedient servant. Unquote. Ever after, he was scrupulously loyal and obedient to the four popes of his career as bishop and cardinal. He retired in the 1970s to live with other retired priests and lay people in the nursing home run by the Little Sisters of the Poor in Randwick. And the main interest then was to accompany the Brown Nurses Congregation Sisters in visiting poor people in Sydney. So the term servant does capture well a key aspect of his life, which was obedience to a sense of vocation and then to the calls and demands that followed. When seeking a subtitle for my biography, I settled on An Obedient Life. All the above should demonstrate Gilroy's importance as an Australian churchman and perhaps indicate a more complex personality behind the clerical facade. Nevertheless, it took me some time to come to this appreciation. In the 1990s, I was teaching church history at a seminary and also looking for a topic for a PhD thesis. I settled on a study of Norman Gilroy's role as Archbishop of Sydney. As a thesis topic, it had the advantages that it was largely unexplored in Australian religious history, and that local primary sources would hopefully be available. And that actually turned out to be a problem. In the beginning, it was primarily an administrative study focused on the Sydney Archdiocese. Inevitably, the life of Gilroy and its broader context took my attention. Even if one were to accept that Norman Gilroy was a mediocre, conventional, and unattractive churchman, his life was interesting and varied. There was the young Norman in a poor, struggling family in Glebe in 1900. A decade later at Gallipoli for the Anzac landings. In 1922, studying in Rome, and Mussolini and his black shirts are pouring into Italy to take over. There's the brief period in Lismore, then he's parachuted into the apostolic delegation, North Sydney. And there he becomes involved for the first time in the cause of Mary MacKillop. Next, he's a young bishop in depressed South Australia. And finally, his 3 decades in Sydney gave great insight into how the Australian Church reacted to World War II, the Cold War, the Labour split, Vatican II, and all the crises of the 1960s. And then there was the company he mixed with. Five popes, many religious leaders of other faiths, Queen Elizabeth II, Emperor Hirohito, President Diem, before he was assassinated, Australian Prime Ministers, and other political leaders. Even in his retirement, he was in company with B. Miles at the Little Sisters of the Poor in Randwick. So he lived in interesting times and dealt with interesting people. After the thesis, I contemplated a biography and researched some gaps, such as Gilroy's student years in Rome and his time as Bishop of Port Augusta, 1935 to 37. However, sources were a problem. Gilroy himself showed little interest in having his life recorded. His few writings and his speeches are very formal, even laboured, and they lack the wit and the sharpness of leaders like Archbishop Mannix. Most problematic was the policy of the Sydney Archdiocese and Chancery that personal papers of a deceased Archbishop of Sydney would not be available for research until 50 years after his death. In Gilroy's case, that would be 2027. The biography seemed to be out of the question. After Archbishop Pell arrived in Sydney, I noted that his biography was written by Tess Livingston in 2002. So in 2011, I informed him that I wished to embark on a biography of Gilroy and would like his support. He readily agreed and provided me with a letter of recommendation. That letter led to extensive access to Sydney Archdiocesan archives and was helpful in approaching other archivists. I was very anxious that the biography not be characterised as a hagiography or propaganda piece commissioned by the church. It was a personal initiative intended as contributing to Australian religious history. It was not commissioned or financed by either the Catholic Church or the Gilroy family, although I had approval and cooperation from both groups. Nor did Cardinal Pell or his successor, Archbishop Fisher, see the text before it was published. I did send individual chapters to people who may have been featured in a chapter asking for their comments, but none of those asked for any substantial revision. So the great blessing was that I could research and write independently with no real restraints. John DeLuca's thoughtful and positive review in the Swag, that's autumn of this year, commended St. Paul's Publications for, quote, the physical volume which is beautifully presented and easy to read. The font is large and the layout beyond reproach, unquote. And I also am most grateful to St. Paul's for the smooth editing process and the quality final production. So it's at the end. Hopefully, the biography will encourage a new interest in Gilroy and his times. Readers' comments so far and my own reflection suggest that there are still some puzzle points and gaps in the story. So here are a few post-biography reflections. Prevailing understandings of Gilroy have been limited, partial, and superficial. People remember his formal public image and his general style of leadership. Because there has been no extended biography, most writing about him has been in relation to a few key issues, like the state aid debate, clashing with B.A. Santa Maria and Daniel Mannix over the movement, bringing Pope Paul VI to Sydney. And the critics have handed down stories of harshness inflexibility, thrift, particularly in his dealings with diocesan clergy and religious congregations. Father Edmund Campion once wrote a short piece about the extreme formality and aloofness of Gilroy as a bishop, and wondered what had happened to the young man of his 1915 diary, where he recalls climbing the Sphinx in Egypt, avidly attending plays and the music halls in London. And Campion titled his article, "A Necessary Isolation," implying that Gilroy consciously chose this aloof detachment as priest and bishop. His seminary diaries suggest that seminary formation may have led to this behaviour. And there are a few stories of his retirement days which indicate that later he was able to shed a bit of that informality, or sorry, that formality. Gilroy's application to enter the Jesuit order in 1933 raises tantalising questions which I have not managed to explore. Was he disillusioned with the bureaucratic roles he had been given in his first decade as a priest in the diocese? Was he trying to avoid becoming a bishop? He most likely knew that in 1931 he had been considered for the role of Bishop of Rockhampton. Did he tell his own bishop, John Carroll, about his ambition to seek annihilation in the Society of Jesus? One would presume he did. There are also questions about his appointment as coadjutor Archbishop of Sydney in 1937 and his elevation to the cardinalate in 1946. Brenda Nile, in her recent biography of Archbishop Mannix, elaborates a Vatican chess game managed by the new Archbishop Apostolic Delegate Panico and seeking to replace Irish bishops with Australian-born clergy, and particularly to undermine the influence of Archbishop Mannix. Patrick Morgan took a similar view in a paper delivered at the Australian Catholic Historical Society in 2017, which includes a section on Panico's plan. Their view is borne out by the documents relating to the resignation of Archbishop Sheehan and the speedy appointment of Gilroy to Sydney. Nile, however, further implies that Gilroy was cultivating Panico. In 1936, all the bishops and Panico were in Adelaide for an education conference. After the conference, Gilroy invited Panico to his diocese of Port Augusta and drove him on a road tour around the diocese. Nile's description of Gilroy's invitation as, quote, "a shrewd diplomatic move," unquote, "a shrewd diplomatic move," unquote, is plausible, but could hardly apply to his appointment to Sydney, because in 1936 Archbishop Sheehan was still the designated successor to Archbishop Kelly. Gilroy's elevation to be cardinal in 1946 is characterised by Morgan and Nile as a last move by Panico in the chess game and a final snub to Mannix. Again, this is plausible, but difficult to substantiate. The final decision was with the Vatican rather than Panico, and it could be argued that the status of Sydney as the foundational Australian archdiocese influenced the Roman choice, as it has done for all later choices as cardinals. You could say the same of the simultaneous 1946 elevation of Archbishop Bernard Griffin of Westminster in England. Roger Pryke, who was Panico's secretary in 1945 to 46, maintained that Panico had no prior knowledge of the appointment. And John O'Brien examined Panico's involvement and concluded that until the Vatican archives are opened, one can only speculate. Well, biographers can easily become cheerleaders for their subjects. And my biography takes quite a favourable view of Gilroy, although I hope it's not taken as hagiography. I'm aware of his many critics, particularly clergy and members of religious congregations. I just repeat the conclusion in the biography that there is a kaleidoscope of views about Gilroy, from aristocratic, patriarchal, sarcastic, remote, and rigidly conservative, to humble, spiritual, caring, pastoral, whimsical, wise, and efficient. There's probably truth in all these memories, but each is generally limited and partial. It's hoped that this and further biographical study will provide a more complete understanding of a man who did not seek the major roles he was given, but undertook them in obedience and loyalty and to the best of his ability. Thank you.
Ed Campion.
Fellow Sydneysiders, a few days ago I told a friend that Gerard Henderson had just asked me to speak here tonight to give what he called a personal reflection on Cardinal Gilroy. You should say, said my friend, that you once wrote a book, A Place in the City, the first sentence of which is, "It wasn't much fun living in the same house as Cardinal Gilroy." True, true. But I wasn't there for fun. I was there half a century ago to be curate in the cathedral parish. As such, I mainly saw the Cardinal at meals in the rather formal dining room. And there, the heavy questions of archdiocese and policy and its implementation were never discussed. And if a visitor tried to raise them, the Cardinal would cut him short. "I see the Bishop of Winnipeg has died," he might say. Or if the visitor persisted, "Have a banana, Father." Meals, I wrote in A Place in the City, were meant to be recreation from the weighty matters of church and state considered elsewhere in the building. What ships were in the harbour? The vagaries of familiar clients of the cathedral's aid? Oddities from the day's news? These were safe subjects. The adamantine rule was never to mention another priest at table, lest you unwittingly said anything that could somehow discredit him. Thus, A Place in the City. It was, I wrote, as if you were under house arrest. Sitting at the other end of the dining room table, I noticed something that seemed to me to be a residue, a surviving habit from his Roman education, and that is, he always gave people their proper titles: His Grace, His Excellency, Monsignor, Father, never first names or nicknames. Nor did he encourage gossip about those in power. Power, he knew, was a network, a web, a seamless construct. Damage any part of it and the whole thing would suffer. I often remembered King James I's response to the Presbyterian divines who were arguing for the abolition of bishops. "No bishop, no king," he said. And it goes without saying, of course, that no unkind comment was ever voiced about the Bishop of Rome. The Holy Father, as the Cardinal always called him, although we might say the Pope. Yet such deference wasn't accorded to understrappers of the Vatican. When Pope Paul was coming to Sydney at the end of 1970, the cathedral dean spent some hours getting the sight lines of the altar exactly right for television cameras in the clerestory of the cathedral. A few days later, two Monsignori from the Vatican turned up and moved the altar out of line. How did the meeting go with the Vatican people? Asked Gilroy that night. They moved the altar we had spent hours getting a line for the TV cameras, complained the dean. Move it back, said Gilroy. He wasn't going to have his man pushed around by blow-ins. His life seemed lonely, however filled with constant interviews, ceremonies, and public occasions. A man of prayer, yes, but a lonely man. John Luttrell's book tells us that he relaxed on Sunday nights in the family home, but there's no mention of personal friends, mates. Let me tell you a story about that. When a priest was to be transferred from the cathedral to work elsewhere, a high tea was given in his honour, at which we each spoke. One such I remember vividly, the farewell to a scripture scholar who was joining the seminary staff. In his speech, the Cardinal acknowledged that seminary authorities had made several requests for this man's service, and each time, until now, the Cardinal had refused them. Why? He said that he hated to lose any of the cathedral men because, and here I'm quoting him, in the necessary isolation of a bishop's life, you are like a family to me. The necessary isolation of a bishop's life. What psychic costs is contained in that reading of a bishop's responsibility? Now let me tell you two stories where Cardinal Gilroy came into my own life. Back then, the Church had reintroduced into the Mass an ancient call and response form of prayer to focus on the issues of the day. It was called Prayers of the Faithful. And the bishops had produced a book of sample prayers with the instruction that if other prayers were added, they should be written out, not done extempore. Well, one Sunday I was on the High Mass with Cardinal Gilroy presiding. It was a special occasion, Red Cross Sunday, I think, and he was there to show his support. Now, a week earlier, Father Dan Berrigan, an American Jesuit and protester against the Vietnam War, had been arrested by the FBI. I wrote out a prayer for him and added it to the prayers of the faithful. Cardinal Gilroy was not happy. He instructed the secretary to excise my prayer from the tape before it was broadcast on the radio that night. The next day, I wrote him a letter to say that, as instructed by the bishops, I had written out the prayer for a brother priest in good standing with his religious order, who was now in trouble. Leaving the dining room, he stopped and told me that I hadn't understood. He was presiding at the Mass, so people might think he had authorised the prayer. Well, this wasn't the end of the story. A few weeks later, he inserted a sentence into the table talk. He said, I see Father Berrigan's superiors have declared him in good standing with their order. And he looked down the table to where I sat at the bottom. I must say I admired him for that amende honorable. Here's another story. After I'd been at the cathedral for about a year, I started an independent newsletter called Report. Its aim was to carry the news that the Catholic press, for whatever reason, didn't print. Report began the week Pope Paul released his encyclical Humanae Vitae against contraception. So there was plenty of news to gather. As well as this, the Daily Press, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian liked what we wrote and often enough ran stories sourced in Report. An assiduous reader of the Sydney Morning Herald, the Cardinal was aware of us. Well, after some months, his principal secretary came to me and said he felt he had to tell Gilroy that I was the main writer of the stories he was reading about in the paper. I told him to go ahead, which he did, to be told, "You're not saying, are you? No, you're not, that Father Campion is printing material he's getting in here." And the Cardinal passed on to the next item on the agenda. An admirable man. Here's another story that shows him as a man of his time. When Humanae Vitae came out in 1968, I went to the press conference in the crypt of the cathedral. I knew some of the journalists there, two of them women. Cardinal Gilroy sat at a table covered with a worn green cloth with Bishop Muldoon and two or three desiccated theologians. The Cardinal opened proceedings. "Good afternoon, gentlemen," he said. Oh, since I'm speaking at the Sydney Institute, I expect you want me to say something about politics. To this day, however, I can't tell which way Cardinal Gilroy voted. I direct you to John Luttrell's book for more information on that. One thing I found in the book that startled me so much that I copied it into my notebook to mull over on the bus or at coffee. Towards the end of 1963 or the beginning of 1964, the Archbishop of Bombay, Cardinal Gracius, had an invitation from B.A. Santa Maria to speak at a conference he was organising. What to do? Gracius wrote to Cardinal Gilroy for advice. Did he know this man, Santa Maria? Should he accept the invitation? Back came Gilroy's reply. It's on page 265 of John Luttrell's book. And this is what Cardinal Gilroy wrote to Cardinal Gracius. The person who wrote to you not only has not the confidence of the greater part of the Australian hierarchy, but is regarded by them as one of the most harmful influences there has been in the Australian Church. As so often in the history of the Church, quarrels are between good men on both sides of an argument.
So many thanks to John Luttrell and Ed Campion. As I said, we've got copies of John's book, Norman Gilroy, An Obedient Life, in the paperback edition at $27.95, a good bargain. We're selling it tonight at the special $27.95 at the Special Institute, Sydney Institute price of $28, because we don't have change. And there's the hardback edition where you can get one book for the price of two, plus a discount. But well worth purchasing. So I'm going to get both our speakers to come up here, stand on either side, and we'll lead off question discussion and finish no later than the top of the hour. Can I just start off to both of you? You stay. Oh, that's fine, yeah. To both of you. Page 265 of your book, which Ed Campion's quoted about Bob Santa Maria. Now, the question is, just coming closer here, the question is whether Gilroy was a bit of a wheeler dealer who was into what Malcolm Fraser called doing the hypocrisies, because there is in Santa Maria's papers a letter that Gilroy wrote to Santa Maria in the late 50s, early 60s, where Santa Maria sent him a pamphlet, and Gilroy wrote back to him, "Dear Mr. Santa Maria," and he concludes the letter, it's a brief letter, saying, "You always write the truth beautifully expressed." Now that's documented. Santa Maria told the story that when he met the Pope in Sydney, and Pope Pius VI in 1970, he was introduced to the apostolic delegation by Gilroy, and that Gilroy said to the Pope that Santa Maria was one of Australia's finest living Catholics. Now the second one is hearsay, the first one is documented. So did he say different things to different people, or was he always consistent? So we'll start with you, John, we'll get a comment from Ed, and then we'll go to...
Well, I'm not, Gerard, I'm not aware of that second quotation, and I can imagine that in writing, he was always very careful in the way he wrote. There was nothing which, similar to what Ed was saying in addressing people, there was nothing which he thought might be misconstrued. My conclusion, I think, is that he certainly was very much against the Santa Maria position in regard to the movement. And in terms of things like banning the Catholic Weekly being sold and anything which might support, say, the Democratic Labour Party, he was quite strong in all of that. So if Cardinal Gracias in 63 asks that question, I think all of that would be behind it. I can't be sure as to whether he would be two-faced, if you like, in what you're saying in writing the other opinion.
I think the reference there, we'll go to Ed, was the banning of the National Civic Council's News Weekly being sold in Sydney, not the Catholic Weekly. Ed?
I'm sorry, yes.
I have a different story from you, Gerard, on that. Archbishop Matthew Blagojevich, his diary, says, in his diary, he writes that in 1953, when Archbishop Carboni came here to be the Pope's representative, it was a very hot weekend, and he went out with another bishop and had a meal with Carboni, and he says in his diary for 1953 that we told the Archbishop that B.A. Santa Maria was the outstanding layman in the Australian Church. And so the story went on, and when I read the diary for a lecture I gave in London University, which is published and it's in the Mitchell Library, I noticed that Blagojevich, as you would know, Gerard, turned against Santa Maria, someone he'd known very much, and reading his diary as an older man, he wrote alongside that story, "Mea culpa." And he went on to stop Santa Maria from being invited to any church function in Adelaide. So the quotation is from Blagojevich, not someone else, and he denies it afterwards.
Okay, so we've got a question there.
How highly developed was Gilroy's sense of humour, and which of he and Mannix was the more tight-fisted?
Well, I can only say neither Archbishop ever gave me anything, so I can't answer that question on their tight fitness. I wasn't aware of Norman Gilroy's sense of humour at all. And I certainly read witty things said by Dr. Mannix.
Yes, there was a bit of music there, yeah.
There was one story of Cardinal Gilroy saying to a priest afterwards, after he'd given some sort of talk at any rate, and I forget the incident itself, but as he walked past the priest, he said, "There's one more for your repertoire, Father." So...
Okay, so just come back. Just don't keep moving away from the microphone. Right, so where are we going? There's a question. Michael, yes. Here we go.
John, you know already how much I admire the biography. What a splendid thing it is. So this isn't a criticism, but it does raise a question. In talking about the famous episode where Arthur Calwell publicly criticised the appointment of Gilroy as a cardinal, which in Calwell's opinion was an honour that belonged or should have belonged to Daniel Mannix. I think in your book you use, I've forgotten the adjective, but it seems to indicate that Mannix showed anger at that appointment. Well, from my knowledge, that wasn't really Mannix's style. He might have felt anger, but he chose other ways of expressing his views. And he organised a very warm welcome to Gilroy on his first visit to Melbourne as the first ever Australian cardinal. And in speaking, and you quote this in the book, Mannix's way of making a point was to compare Gilroy with another famous cardinal from the English-speaking world, John Henry Newman. It was as if he was saying, think of it, the qualities of these two men, how do they compare?
In my quoting that welcome speech, if you like, of Archbishop Mannix, I didn't actually... Anger wasn't the key emotion I thought that I was trying to elicit from that. If anything, I thought it was a put-down, the speech. It was almost that... And I just thought that this man has been made a cardinal. Well, why not accept the umpire's decision? But instead, he compares him to Newman, who also, like at the age of nine, you know, similar age to Mannix, has made a cardinal. But he makes the point that Gilroy just got there by easy stages. He almost did nothing. He was just lucky. And I thought, well, that wasn't all that gracious. And what really struck me was that it was well reported in the Melbourne papers, but the Catholic Weekly did not report that speech. So Gilroy must have taken it badly, I think, or someone took it badly. So that's my how what Mannix actually thought. I'm not sure, but I just thought it was a bit ungracious, the whole thing.
Question here:
did Cardinal Gilroy exercise any apparent direction or influence within the church at the time of the Vietnam War and attitudes to it?
Yes, he was a trust the government man. He said the governments were it's the Pauline doctrine of the governments reflect the will of God, and he was a trust the government man. That story was copied in the New York Times and so on.
Certainly in the beginning it was very strongly trust the government. I think around about 1970-71, as the war was really getting out of the control of the American side, his was still trust the government, but he wasn't very strong on actually trying to have a victory. It was more like let's have peace if we can, but he certainly didn't condemn the government.
Just going back on. Going back on the speech you refer to, I spoke to someone who was there at that speech and said that most people there didn't quite get it, thought that Daniel Mannix was praising Cardinal Gilroy, but when you went home and thought about it, you came away with a different impression. I record he did speak about the enormous contribution that Cardinal Gilroy has made to the future of the Catholic Church in the Diocese of Port Augusta, and spoke about his wonderful war service as a telegram boy off the coast, on a ship off the coast of Gallipoli, which I think many people there thought was wonderful praise until you realised he was having a go. Yeah.
And I remember when Tom Fitzgerald wrote that marvellous profile of Daniel Mannix in Nation back in 1958. He told me he was reading and he came to that speech, and he's reading on the bus and he leapt up with the irony of Mannix's speech. I quite agree with you, Jared.
There's one up there, then we go here. Yeah.
Melbourne, Sydney, Mannix, Gilroy, you couldn't get two more opposite kind of constellations. In the battle over state aid, where do you think Gilroy played a part? Because when it's all said and done, while Mannix caused an enormous amount of sectarianism by being the tribal leader, fighter, whatever, that was the reason state aid, the reason the government eventually gave in. And Gilroy was very happy to open the schools, but do you really think he made a big contribution to that state aid debate?
I think that the debate went for quite a while. I think the Mannix more activist approach would be the early 60s, and especially, say, the strike in Goulburn, and which seemed to come from the southern area, Goulburn, Wagga, that they were supporting that very activist view. Gilroy, and by that, and very soon James Carroll, took the view that that's going to cause sectarian resurgence and would be counterproductive. And whether for right or wrong, in a sense, their view tended to get the support of the bishops, I think. So that in the mid-60s and late 60s, the government wanted to deal with the bishops, and James Carroll was the one sort of heading of all that. So he was sort of, if you like, Gilroy's advisor and the one who looked after that, especially during Vatican II, when Gilroy was away. My feeling is that it became a fairly general cause. Everyone was behind it, the activists, the bishops and the laity, because, you know, it was pretty desperate. And I think it's a bit hard to say which side was more decisive than the other. I think the Goulburn and the activists sort of, if you like, say, started the, you know, really dramatised the whole thing in the beginning, but then Gilroy or Carroll said, look, we've got to hose down these wild men of Goulburn, and he did a lot of work to try and take a different approach. Now, who was the final most influential person is pretty hard to say, I think. And it's really in the late 60s that you get the massive aid coming through, with all of those lay meetings around the cities and things like that.
John, in your weighing of the Cardinal, you still have puzzle points. If both of you were psychiatrists, do you have a primary hypothesis as to what might be divining the missing bit or the missing ingredient that would finalise your weighing?
Well, the puzzle points were more individual, not exactly issues or incidents. I mentioned, for instance, joining the Jesuits and why he applied for that. Whether they point to something deeper and greater, that could well be. I'm not sure about that. But I do think there was some sort of unease there, or some sort of thing that he's still looking for, you know, even as a young priest. But then he's asked to be bishop, and he just sort of says yes, and that's it for the rest of his life. But even in his diary, when he goes to England as a layman in 1915 after Gallipoli, he he doesn't really play around, you know, like he goes to plays and all that sort of thing, but he's fairly unusual as a man on the loose, you know, early 20s or about 21, whatever it was, you know, amongst sailors and that in England. And he visits a priest and he talks to a priest, he befriends a priest over there. It's there's something there that he's sort of searching for all the time. Not a psychiatrist.
Yes, I'd agree with John on that. I think the key to him is given in the subtitle of this book. His basic virtue was obedience. He did what he was told. There's an interesting story in that diary, that Gallipoli diary, when he's going through the sewers. He gets off at Cairo, and the future Cardinal Archbishop of Sydney says, why are the shops all closed? They said, because it's Good Friday. Oh, is it? That would change.
Coming near the end now, so...
Thank you. I just wanted to respond, I think, to Father Ed's observation about the sense of humour or no sense of humour. And I can always recall to this day, in 1948, receiving some prizes at the Stellenbosch's College Prize Day from Cardinal Gilroy, and I was trembling, went up onto the stage, and he pulled me out quietly with the books, said a couple of things which were extremely funny.
Yes.
And put me totally at ease. And on leaving that, I thought, what a terrific man.
Good, yeah.
So,
what a pity, though, that you hadn't spoken to John Luttrell before he wrote his book.
I think this might be the last. I'm
interested in the issues that people raise as to whether Cardinal Gilroy was politically motivated. And the only thing I can say is I lived in Brighton Sands, and I know where Trafalgar Street is, and I remember quite vividly his sisters, and there are other family members in Brighton Sands. And if they're any guide to Cardinal Gilroy's character and general hopes, they were very humble people, they were thoughtful people, they were very pious people. They had no political critical viewpoint. Everyone voted Labour and Brighton Sands. Yeah, absurd.
You would have
had to be an eccentric not to be a supporter of the Labour Party. But there was something very dignified and very good about those people. And that's an indication of where Cardinal Gilroy was. That's what I think it was.
The suggestion is that God and everyone else in Brighton Le Sands voted for the Labour Party. We might conclude on that, John, and then.
Thank you.
Oh, I thought we were going to get a response. So just a response on whether he was so much in the tradition of Catholic Labour in New South Wales that he simply went along with that. That's the point.
Yeah. I think you might have to distinguish between New South Wales Labour and Federal Labour. He didn't like being called, or he didn't like people referring to the Evatt Catholics or the Gilroy Catholics after the split. However, he was obviously a very close friend of the New South Wales Premier, Joe Carl, and I think in terms of things like school aid and all that, he probably thought that the New South Wales, that's where his friends were. And I don't think he was currying favour there. I just think he got on well with them. Joe Carl was a close friend. He spoke at his funeral and so on. I think the federal scene might have been different and might have changed over the years. I'm not sure. Apparently, he and Bob Menzies used to talk on the telephone after he retired. So.
Yes, that's a happy memory. Yes, he was close to Menzies, but then I can remember Menzies' letter to News Weekly and saying how much he appreciated what B.A. Santa Maria was doing. It's typical of politicians at that level that they can, whoever they are, they can get on together, isn't it? And I agree with certainly what you say, that it was unthinkable for many, many, many Catholics in that era not to vote Labour. Unthinkable. And indeed, part of the DLP story is precisely that it dislodged some of those people from the Labour Party and they ended up where they ended up.
Many thanks. Well, thanks to our two speakers tonight for a very insightful look at a particular important man in Australian history and a particularly important time in Australian history. So, as I said, we've got copies of Norman Thomas Gilroy, An Ordinary Life by John, and Ed's well known for his many writings on this this subject and many other subjects over a long time. So thanks to both of you tonight for a great night.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.